Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show, October 17th, 2008. Our guest tonight is a continuation of last week's guest, Dr. Michael Brooks, who wrote a book, 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, and that's just a few. I think he could do another 20 if he wanted to. And Michael Brooks is a formerly a senior editor at the and now a consultant for New Scientist, in which the widely popular article on which this book was based first appeared. His writing has appeared in The Guardian, The Independent, and The Observer. He lives in England. And we've had the first hour of this show. If you didn't catch it last week when it aired Friday night on the 10th and Saturday night, you really want to go back and get the first part of this, because this has been one of the most fascinating physicists, scientists we've ever had on this program. So, Michael, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Great. Well, we're up to we're going through your book, and I'm up to the fifth. We're up to the fifth element now. That's the good one, and that's pretty clever from that movie, The Fifth Element. And you have
that's
it
right.
Twice. That you, what were you, what, was that a coincidence, or did you actually do that on purpose?
Like, no, it's purely coincidence, if you believe in such things.
Yeah. Well, it depends on. We can talk about Schrodinger's cat.
Yeah.
And go there if you want. Anyway. How do I start this thing about life itself? And that is Schrodinger.
What is life? I mean, that's the ultimate question, isn't it? You know, we don't have a clue. We don't know why some things are, you know, classified as alive and some things are not. You know, everything's composed of molecules and atoms. So what is it that makes me alive and yet the chair I'm sitting on dead? I've not got an answer to that, and nobody on earth has an answer to that.
Yeah, no, I know, but let's go into what some of the things you said about that are.
Yeah.
And, I like to, right off the bat, the DNA side of it's always been fascinating me with the gene of telomeres. It's real interesting how, and I know you, I think you talked about that in here somewhere, it's interesting how, you know, the science has played around on a biochemistry level, and it does seem like to me that we are living longer now than we did a while back. But then when you go back to supposedly Atlantean times when Methuselah lived 450 years, I think we still got some missing elements here. That's my
opinion. Yeah. It's one of the things I talked about in a subsequent chapter, actually. I talk about life, but I also talk about death as an anomaly.
Well, we can mix those two up if you want.
So yeah, I mean, I think that it's really interesting that, you know, we have this idea that, you know, we know what shortens life in effect. You know, we lose the ends of the telomeres in the DNA, and we can put those back, but then, you know, things run out of control, and, you know, you end up with cancers and things. So we're kind of tinkering around with this whole thing. But, you know, the point of starting with life is to try and understand what it is. You know, because people are trying to build life from scratch. And I went to Los Alamos, which was quite a freaky day out, I have to say, to the National Laboratory there and talked to a guy who's, you know, literally trying to put some molecules together and in the right way in order for them, you know, to come alive, to create a new kind of living creature. Which is just an extraordinary scientific endeavor. And, you know, there are people who say he should be stopped, you know, that he's playing God. And I don't think he is at all. I think he's literally, you know, he's playing chemistry. But, you know, what's interesting is where does chemistry turn into biology?
Yeah. That was my weakest, you know, I always thought chemistry was fascinating as a subject in college, but it was my weaker one, you know, I don't know why. I just didn't like this. I didn't like all the mathematics involved in chemical reactions. That got to be boring. I don't know if that's...
It can become very dry.
Very dry. That's the English way of saying it. It got very
like being boring.
In a desert. You know, H2O, I can figure that out pretty quick, but beyond that, I'm in deep trouble. Yeah, how'd you
but
like...
The thing
I used to have an electronics company before when I was at NASA for a while, and then when I left, I had an electronics company, and I was a consultant, and I used to go up to Los Alamos. Just going in that place was fascinating. I mean, there was so much going on there. This has been a long time ago. You probably went there more recently.
It was pretty recent. They just had a big security scare because, I don't know if you remember, there was a woman who was working in the laboratory who basically took nuclear secrets home by accident.
Yeah, I remember. She went in right behind that.
Yeah, and I went in right behind that. So I was trying to get clearance to go into the lab at this time. And you can imagine, you know, the place was just nailed shut. You know, it was just dreadful. And in the end, I was allowed to meet this researcher off the Los Alamos campus. And, you know, we kind of had lunch together. But I'm pretty sure I was followed around most of the day as well, I have to say. So, you know, they were in high alert mode. And it was one of those days that it was just kind of will live forever in my memory, this kind of sense of being followed and just spooked out the whole time.
So
it's an amazing place.
Yeah, it is. I always made contact to get in there with people that needed test equipment and stuff for their experiments. That was my way in. But I imagine you just contacted. Did you hear about the research that was going on before you went there, or did you find out about it once you got there?
No, I knew about it, and I was trying to get access to the laboratory to kind of go and have a look at this thing. Yeah, the idea that there's this test tube where this guy is putting these chemicals together, and you know, one day may produce something that's alive. I just really wanted to see that because, you know, it'd just be an extraordinary thing. But I wasn't allowed anywhere near it, and his lab was strictly off limits to me. So
really,
Well, you know, you have to remember that I'm English too, so I'm kind of, you know, not a non-citizen of the U.S., so I was even, you know, even less likely to get in there, really.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, in a lot of trouble. But I think, you know, the fundamentals of it are just amazing, and just the idea that, you know, we might one day put these things together. And of course, Craig Venter, you know, the genome guy, the genome pioneer, is doing this by kind of pulling everything out of a bacterium and then putting in a different genome and trying to create a new organism that way. I would say that he's just kind of doing engineering rather than creating life. But, you know, I guess it's a step along the way.
Yeah, well, you know, there's some interesting new viruses that have been discovered fairly recently that replicate the maintenance functions and reproduction functions of bacteria.
Yeah,
I don't know if you wrote about them in your book or not, but I don't remember.
I didn't. I think that all came out actually after the book had kind of been finished and gone to press. But you know, I mean, I've got this chapter as well. I mean, you know, we kind of mixed a lot up on viruses, and viruses are turning out to be much, much more interesting than biologists have ever given them credit for. You know, and they may be at the root of the kind of tree of life. You know, we always think of viruses as parasites that need something to host them. But it may be that in the long ago in their evolutionary history, viruses were actually very much part of the biosphere and just, you know, kind of took on this role. And of course, you know, a huge chunk of our own DNA is kind of ancient virus DNA. So who knows sort of what really went on there. And,
so this
whole question of life and not life, I mean, classically, scientists say viruses aren't alive. But of course, you know, they're having to change that definition now because it's becoming absolutely clear that viruses are in some way alive. But, you know, again, they straddle this kind of link between, you know, biology and chemistry.
Yeah. And then another subject that I've looked at, and you probably have too, is junk DNA.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting how much of our ancestry is still genetically coded into our present-day DNA.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Because you know, I love the idea that, you know, long ago a scientist said, oh, this is just junk.
You know?
And then you know, predicated the next generation of scientists to kind of ignore it. And then all of a sudden somebody found that it wasn't junk at all, but, you know, there's all kinds of interesting things in there.
Yeah,
and,
it's real interesting. People pay a lot of money now to get a DNA blueprint to see if they're susceptible to cancer or arthritis or, you know.
That's right.
You know, that's only happened in the last few years. I forget which group did all that DNA, is back east somewhere, did all that DNA research to put the genetic...
Yeah, I think there's been various groups since they sequenced the human genome. You know, it started to open things out, and it's still pretty crude. And you know, you can't tell everything, but you are starting to be able to tell, you know, various things about yourself from reading the codes that they produce. I don't know how much they charge for these things now. I think it may be in the region of a couple of $1,000s or something.
Yeah, you're right. It's about $2,000. It's not easy.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I'm kind of tempted. You know, as part of me just would love to read my own genetics, you know, be able to have this sense of, you know, who I am and what some of these things mean. And of course, you know, you're never, you know, completely described by your genetics and by your DNA. But But isn't it fascinating that we're starting to be able to kind of deconstruct, you know, what a human being is?
Yeah, and yeah, it is. Now, what do you think? I'm also a very big supporter of stem cell research. I've always told people years ago when I first got my degree in homeopathic medicine, I said, the brain cell can reproduce. Everybody says, no, it can't. Well, guess what? They find out that it can reproduce, you know. I think stem cell research is fascinating too. Have you dove into that much at all? Delved into it?
I haven't delved into it a great deal.
Yeah.
But it's certainly one of those areas that it's just gonna produce so much. I'm convinced of it. I mean, the real shame is that there was this scandal a couple of years ago with the Korean guy who was just fabricating his results. Because of course then everybody said, oh well, you know, the whole thing's a sham. But of course it's not. You know, I mean, science has always had these people who fabricate results to, you know, self-promotion and self-aggrandizement reasons. But actually, you know, stem cell research, you know, could revolutionize what it means to be human, effectively. You know, if we can regrow organs and other aspects of, you know, of our bodies, you know, can be rejuvenated, then, you know, I'm all for that.
Yeah, no, I agree. Now, the next area that I wanted to go into, of course, is in your book, the Vikings. Life on Mars. Now, I personally believe that there was a civilization there a long, long time ago, and that they screwed up their atmosphere like we are ours, and they had some kind of an outgassing or something. Now, this may be way long time ago, but I've always had that feeling. And you talk about the whole thing with the meteorite and all that, and so let's go in and cover that and the bacteria and everything. I mean, that's...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because Mars was habitable, you know, or suitable for life a long time before Earth was.
Right.
So, you know, it that kind of plays into that kind of scenario that there was a civilization, or there could have been a civilization way before, you know, we ever became kind of, you know, aware of any kind of life on Earth, or before there was any life on Earth. I mean, the trouble is, of course, that, you know, people have had these theories before, and, you know, there was the classic Percival Lowell who thought he saw canals on Mars and were the markers of a civilization. And, you know, we just don't know, you know, enough about the history of Mars, really. But, you know, what it seems to me that there was certainly a time in the past where life was, possible, life was tenable on Mars. And if that's the case, then, you know, maybe it evolved to a higher degree, maybe it didn't. But it certainly seems entirely feasible that there could still be microbes on Mars. That, you know, we have microbes on Earth that survive all kinds of harsh conditions, and these extremophiles, as they're called. And it seems to me that, you know, there's no reason why you shouldn't have similarly tolerant and, you know, tenacious microbes on Mars, which is what, you know, the Viking mission or this particular experiment on the Viking mission claimed to see. Then NASA effectively just moved the goalposts on this experiment and said, oh, you know, you know, although you've got a positive result, you know, we're just not going to accept it. And, so, you know, I have to err on the side of caution here and say, well, you know, we don't know. But at the same time, I can't help thinking, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised to find, you know, microbes on the surface of Mars. It's just a shame we haven't really looked properly.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I worked at NASA for 6 years with Wernher von Braun, and my first boss over there was Scott Crossfield, the X-15.
Wow, okay, that's fantastic.
I worked on the Apollo, Saturn, and some submarine guidance stuff.
Yeah.
But first thing I learned working over there was NASA stood for never a straight answer. That's what
I've not heard that before.
Yeah, no, that's never a straight answer because it was politically, I left NASA because it was too politically charged. I just couldn't handle the politics over there as a scientist. I was a senior checkout spacecraft engineer on the Saturn as my last official position there. But previously,
right.
I was the same thing on the Apollo when I worked over in Downey where we built them at North American Aviation. And I never had seen in my life so much politicking going on. It wasn't about, we had cost overrun programs. It wasn't about the science and actually the reliability. When that Saturn took off, we never thought the damn thing would fly. We were amazed that it worked. I'm serious. We would find down in the fuel tanks, because they were huge, and you'd have to go inside them to work on them, we'd find wrenches. left in there by workers and stuff. I mean,
you're kidding me.
Yeah, no, I'm not. No. I don't know how many wrenches probably went through those hydrazine pumps. I don't know, you know. But
that's terrifying.
It was amazing. And electrical connections were bad. And, oh, my God. I had to take a NASA soldering class so that I could inspect solder joints. I mean, I had to go for 5 weeks learning how to solder. I mean, a little each day. I mean, it was amazing what you had to do, how to strip the wire, and tinning it, and if there's just a tiny niche in it, and the vibration of these big engines is going to cause it to fray and break.
Well, of course, yeah.
Yeah, I went through quite a process over there. I was pretty young, and I enjoyed it, but where I ran into some problems was that, once again, the paperclip, the German group that came over that was with Wernher von Braun, they didn't like Americans at all. They did not like us.
And
it was a little, any chance they would get to attack us on any way, verbally or any other way, discipline-wise, they would do it. I mean, I left it after a while. I left right after those guys died on the cake. We lost 3 astronauts, you know, because I could see that coming. We had a lot of fires on we used to call it the bird, and we had so many fires. And you never hear about that in the news, how many times the Apollos caught on fire or the Saturn caught on fire in tests, but quite a few, you know.
Really? Oh.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not surprising, is it? Because the place was kind of inhabited by people who were disaffected and kind of cheesed off with the roles they had.
Well, we were testing. We had a 1,000-gallon tank up on a platform in Seal Beach, you know. We were testing tank pressure with water. We had about 100,000 gallons or whatever the thing held of water. And the tank broke. And there's a guy sitting on top of a crane above the tank, you know, manipulating the tank while they pressurized the tank with water, and the tank broke. So the whole crane disappeared below him. Luckily, the crane stayed intact, but I guarantee he had to change his clothes at the end of the day. Still, Beach got a royal flooding when that water rushed down onto the highway. God. I mean, we had some fun times over there, you know. We really did.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
Well,
anyway,
I mean, this is the thing, you know, the people don't appreciate. They think it is a straight answer. They think, you know, when NASA runs an experiment, you know, it's a kind of yes, no, it worked, it didn't work. And you realize that you know, there's so many levels of politicking, and there's so many levels of almost intrigue and personal ambition that kind of get in the way of all of those things. And for me, it's the saddest thing in the world when, you know, something as fundamental to humanity as discovering life on another planet just falls victim to this kind of thinking. And the guy who was running the experiment that found life on Mars, according to all the criteria that were set out, Gilbert Levin, who's just retired, actually, last month, I think it was, he just finally retired from his company. But he was literally sat in the press conference, he told me this. He was sat in the press conference expecting them to announce that they'd found life on Mars. And the guy running the press conference said, we did not find life on Mars. And he said he was just sat there and his jaw dropped open. And, you know, and that was when he learned that they moved the goalposts, effectively.
Yeah, no, that's in your book. Actually, specifically on page 90, because it's right in front of me here. And I read that and I said, that makes total sense.
I guess to a NASA insider, it would. To me, you know, as somebody who's kind of never been on the inside of an organization like that, I was just stunned by this.
Yeah, they should. I think they should have announced it. That's what I think.
Well, I think they should, yeah.
I think,
or at least kind of, you know, they should have talked about the ambiguities involved. You know, there were subtleties involved in this that they just skated right over. And they ended up, you know, really with egg on their faces over the next decade or so, next 20 years. It was shown that the reasons why they decided not to announce this discovery were all bogus. You know, the experiment that was supposed to have negated the discovery actually was found to be completely flawed.
Yeah, well, in recent times where I've had it out with them, because I have friends over there still, is about the UFO condition around the space station and all these different launches and their denial of that. And possibly, you know, I worked on, when I worked at Autonetics, just before NASA, I was working at Autonetics, and we worked on a laser project called ILAS, which became a Star Wars defense system. It's in space.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I worked on that. It was classified, and I was secret clearance. And today they deny Star Wars. I mean, still. it's they don't deny it. I know it's there. I've seen it in operation, you know. But
right.
So this would be a possibly this thing with Mars could lead to something else, which could lead to where sort of where we're at today. And I think they're really having a real problem now keeping the lid on it, because too many, you know, the big thing with the common public now is quantum physics. I mean, the average Leonard Susskind teaches a class up there at night in Santa Cruz or somewhere in up there in Palo Alto. And he says that his average, he's getting people from their 30s to their 70s and 80s coming to his night classes now to learn basic quantum mechanics, the basic stuff.
Really?
He says that there's
because
a phenomenal...
Because people have
felt
that it was out of reach, but now they're just deciding that they want to know it sort of firsthand for themselves.
And that's what I like about your book, and I hope everybody's listening out there. This book, when you read it, will take you to the next step. This is a real primer with some real deep information in it that will really take you, even me, to another level. And now, speaking of covering up, we come up to the wow signal, which was chapter 7.
Yeah.
And that was real interesting, starting with, what's his name, when he put SETI up, Francis Drake, back in...
Yeah.
In the 60s, you might talk about that a little bit. I found this to be another really good topic.
Well, for me, this is a classic sort of scientific conundrum, because you know we had a scientific paper was published in the 1950s saying if aliens were to try to get in touch, this is probably what they do. You know, this is our best guess at what this signal would look like, and they said, you know, it would be a narrowband signal, so it would be at one frequency. That frequency would be at 1420 megahertz, which is the resonant frequency of a hydrogen molecule.
Right.
And because hydrogen is the most abundant chemical molecule in the universe, then everybody would have experience of hydrogen, and then every civilization would have worked out, you know, its resonance. And therefore, that would be a good kind of, you know, opener to start a conversation, if you like. And so they said, you know, we would have this beam signal at 1420 megahertz and no frequencies either side, you know, very narrow band. And that's exactly what we saw. And, you know, it's just absolutely extraordinary. So we saw it in 1977.
Right, 5 days after my birthday, which was August 10th. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, it was classically, I think it came, was it 3 days before Elvis died or something like that?
Yeah. You know, just, my girlfriend's birthday is on Elvis's day he died.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a kind
August.
Of
fodder
for conspiracy theories there. But
yeah.
And we saw this signal come in, and we didn't see it again. It just disappeared. And the guy who was analyzing the printout at that time, Jerry Amon, just wrote "Wow" beside the printout when he saw it, because it was exactly what everyone had been waiting for. And that's why it's now known as the "Wow" signal. And nobody's ever been able to explain, you know, what it might be if it wasn't an alien communication, or maybe not a communication, but some kind of signal.
Yeah.
And the really fascinating thing, I think, is that, you know, it was a frequency that was banned from use in military and civilian radio broadcasting. There's nothing up there in the region of the sky where it came from. So, you know, there's no natural object that's producing this frequency.
Right.
And there's just no, you know, no reflections from aircraft. Everything's been ruled out, and nobody's got a good explanation for it.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, you just say, well, you know, maybe it was an alien civilization.
Well, I feel it was, but, you know, I feel that once this happened, I think that, once again, the cover-up boys came, and they've gradually been trying to take the SETI program apart anyway. I mean, that's what I've seen. I don't know. It's just coming
it's
apart.
It's certainly true that I don't understand why SETI has just had such a hard time over the years. And there were you know, decades where it was perfectly respectable. You know, it was a perfectly respectable scientific thing to do. And now, you know, it's become almost like fringe science for no reason other than various politicians have kind of stuck the boot in and tried to make it as unfashionable and seem flaky, you know, and basically it's fallen victim to politics. And I don't know what was behind that, apart from, you know, maybe there was just personal ambition for the politicians. But it seems like it's had such a profound effect. I can't help thinking there's more to it than that.
Yeah, no, I think it definitely had to do with some other signals that were detected. And I know Paul Allen, I think from Microsoft.
Yeah.
He's funding some SETI stuff on his own now, I believe.
That's right. I mean, when the federal money basically was cut from the idea of looking for aliens, then a few Silicon Valley entrepreneurs stepped in. So the founders of Hewlett Packard stepped in.
Right, right. Yeah.
And Paul Allen, the Microsoft, you know, co-founder, came in and they said, well, you know, we believe this stuff's important because it is. I mean, yeah, if we can establish some kind of scientific proof that there is life beyond Earth, you know, there are alien civilizations out there, you know, that changes our entire view of the universe.
Yeah.
You know, we're not alone in the universe. It's such a profound issue. And these guys recognize that, I think, and you know, so that they put some money in, you know, into looking for that now. And now the only funder left, I think, is Paul Allen, who is funding the construction of the Allen Array, which is a kind of an array of telescopes that are going to be looking for signals and doing other science as well, I have to say.
Yeah, well, you know.
But even that's difficult because, you know, he wanted it to be, you know, not entirely funded by him, but, you know, but he wanted there to be other sources of funding as well. And that's proved incredibly difficult for the SETI people.
Yeah, no, I agree. The other one, I don't know, you know, the other, you know, getting on the edge of space, of course, is Bert Rutan. And of course, our buddy from England there that owns Virgin Airlines.
Richard Branson.
Richard Branson, and Richard's always been sort of a role model for me. I mean, the guy is, you know, if you compare him with Donald Trump, Richard's kind of more laid back, you know. And,
oh, isn't he though?
Yeah.
I saw him on the news yesterday, in fact, and he's just there with an open shirt, kind of leaning back in a chair. You know, he's just like the most laid back, coolest guy.
It's
incredible.
Yeah, and I think that what we're doing over here in the Mojave Desert, out there by, you know, Edwards Air Force Base with their space program.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be opening up some more. I think it's going to actually fall back. I think there's going to be some ET involvement there somehow. You know, I firmly believe that this country has been working with ETs for quite a while in you know, Barry Goldwater test site, Area 51. Of course, there's not much going on there now. Right,
yeah.
Patterson. And I feel that that's been going on. I feel that that's one of the reasons why they didn't feel the SETI thing was so important, because if they're already here, then why look for them? That was
right.
One of my theories on that. Can't prove it.
Yeah.
I always approach things on this. And then the next area that, of course, we sort of touched on it was the giant virus.
Yeah.
Now,
it sounds like a kind of scary story, but actually, you know, it's just this amazing discovery of a virus that, you know, people thought couldn't possibly be a virus because it was so big, and it turns out that it's, you know, it's very similar to something. Or it looks like something that's really alive. It has, you know, loads of DNA, and it kind of straddles that border between sort of living and chemical, biological and chemical kind of molecules. And so, you know, it's kind of rewriting the story of life in some ways. It's a really fascinating discovery.
Yeah.
And one of these great serendipitous discoveries as well. You know, we weren't looking for it. There was just some kind of public health official basically found it by accident. And in this kind of grim northern town in the north of England. And anyone who knows this town, Bradford, which I'm sure you've never been to.
No, I've never even heard of it.
It's a big city, and nobody really, you know, wants to go there particularly. It's not pretty. It's not a particularly nice place. And the idea that, you know, it's the place where we discovered a giant virus as well, I think just kind of puts the real kibosh on anybody ever visiting this place. It's just extraordinary.
You've been there though, right?
I haven't been there. I actually kind of, you know, I've skirted around it, but I've never actually been there.
What part of England do you live in anyway?
I'm in the southern part of England.
Okay, so down by London or what?
South of London.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Not too far from the Isle of Wight.
Too far from the Isle of Wight, no.
Yeah.
Although that's another place I've never been, you see.
Oh, you gotta go over there. My kids live in
Wight. I know, well, I've heard so much about it. It's supposed to be a really beautiful place.
Yeah, it is. It reminds me a little bit of Laguna Beach without all the traffic where I live.
All the sunshine.
So here. It's horrible, you know. And of course, I like to go to the shipyard down there and go on the HMS Victory. You know that?
Yeah.
Do you ever go down there to?
Yeah, in Portsmouth.
Portsmouth, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been on that so many times. I like it where it says mind thy head, you know. And I went down in there where Admiral Nelson died, you know, down in the bottom of that ship. And boy, I got goosebumps down there. I think in the past life, I might have sailed on that ship. I built a model of it. You know, I love that ship. I don't know why. I love that whole Portsmouth thing, though. The museum over there and all the other boats they got, they're amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you know, we have some great
history. And then now we talked a little bit about death. We kind of were combining that with life.
Yeah.
To me, it's a changing of state. I think that's kind of how you present it, too, you know?
I think that's right. It is a changing of state, and it's just that sense of, you know, can we stop the state changing? I mean, it's the big question, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, we don't really understand what the processes are, and we have these clues from the animal kingdom, you know, these animals that never seem to get old, and you know,
yeah, like
don't
some turtles and some fish, they find their way out.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, these turtles that I think they're in southern Michigan or somewhere. You know, that nobody's ever found one that's kind of, you know, dying of old age, basically.
Yeah.
You know, these things are just seem to go on and on. They keep reproducing. They don't seem to have any problem kind of, you know, they don't seem to have this degradation that humans face. And so in evolutionary terms, they're not that distant from us. So there's the hope that, you know, if they have some, you know, some fortuitous way of avoiding this problem of getting old and decrepit, then maybe there's, you know, genetic switches that we can flick, and all of a sudden, you know, we can avoid this horrible kind of degradation that comes with the years.
Yeah, it sucks. I know, because I'm 64 now, and or 65. I don't even remember anymore. I keep in really good shape, work out and all that, but
yeah,
I can't. I used to be a runner. I don't enjoy running anymore. I used to love exercise and martial arts. I don't like exercise anymore. I do it. But I used to do it because I had so much energy. Now I do it to keep the energy that I've got going, you know.
Well, it would be great, wouldn't it, if we could, you know, just find a way to stop that happening. You know, it's one of the most depressing things as you get older. You sort of realize that, you know, you can't just run around and you know, without warming up these days. You know, and you suddenly realize that if you injure yourself, it takes, you know, a couple of years in some cases to really, you know, get right again.
I used to get daredevil on motorcycles, and I have a motorcycle collection. But all the Rice Rocket that I have, I'm selling that. I bought it in 2000. I won't ride it anymore. That was 8 years ago. In 8 years, I've evolved out of that. You know, I'll ride an old Triumph around. My favorite bikes, by the way, are Triumphs and Nortons from your country.
Oh, wow.
Classics. I have a Manx. We can't start the Manx, though. It's strictly a bump start thing, and that thing is... But I like to ride some of the other... I got a Triumph Bonneville. I love riding that.
Wow.
You can't beat a good bike, you know, motorcycle. Yeah, so
California
anyway...
California is the place to do it.
Yeah. And then, of course, the next area that we covered, boy, we're eating time up here. We only got a half an hour left. Sex. That's always a good one. You know, when you see a book with all this physics in here and then we get to sex, that's pretty interesting. It says we got a broadband physicist here on the end, you know?
Well, you know, it was broadband for me. Actually, it stretched me quite a lot, this kind of idea of having to look at this. But, you know, I kind of set out, I think, you know, to try and work out what was going on with science, you know, that was kind of overarching theme of the book, was to kind of say, you know, what are these results, you know, that kind of don't make sense, that nobody really can understand, and what do they mean? And of course, when I started digging into it, you know, it's kind of easier in a sense to find those in physics. You know, we have these anomalies that nobody can understand. And then you start looking at biology, and you know, when you find that the biologists admit that there are a couple of things that really make no sense to them at all, and one of them is sex. You just can't believe it. You know, you sort of think we had evolution all pegged. You know, everything is kind of, it's a very neat theory. You know, the idea of survival of the fittest, you know, evolution by natural selection. You just thought that, you know, everything that we observe fits nicely into that. But it turns out that that's not the case at all. And I discovered all these eminent biologists who are writing, you know, had written in their books that sex just completely defeats all of them, you know, which completely took me by surprise. And the basic problem is that it's much more efficient, biologically speaking, to reproduce asexually, that is to clone yourself, because you can do it faster and you can produce more young, so you can outcompete anything around you. And yet the fact is, when you look around the natural world, very few things reproduce asexually. So, you know, so why would that be? You know, when you look at it on paper, it's the best way to do it. In the natural world, you know, it doesn't happen hardly at all. So there's this complete kind of anomaly here that nobody can explain.
Yeah, I think it's one of the parameters of the mystery of life and why we're on Earth in the first place. That's one we got to figure out. Because
well,
I know in the
thing,
human gene,
you know,
desire pretty much runs our society, and desire produced between the attraction of the opposite sex.
That's right. I mean, it's supposed to be such a dominant force, isn't it? I mean, it is such a dominant force in animals, in people. You know, it's a really big driver for all living creatures, and yet it's much more complex and subtle than we kind of ever appreciated. Really.
Oh, you're totally right with that one. I like the way bees and flowers do it. They buzz around on the pestle of the flower, and the flower basically has sex with itself because the bees.
Yeah.
That works for me.
It's a beautiful system when you start to look at it, and you see the kind of variety that there is in nature, and the different ways that animals interact and you know have these kind of different kinds of relationships as well. You know, the chapter kind of goes into at some point, you know, the fact that so many social animals have much more complicated relationships than just, you know, male female sex. You know, there's all kinds of social bonds. And you sort of realize that actually maybe it's all a bit more complicated than we
especially with
like
spiders, for example, like the black widow.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, how did that ever come about?
Huh?
How did that ever come about?
I don't know, but I mean, he kills her, and then there's the praying mantis beheads the opposite one when they get done. I mean,
that's right. The female beheads the male, I think. And
yeah.
Yeah, no, it makes you glad to be human, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, here, you know, I watch court TV a lot over here, and there's always a good one on how the husband, you know, arsenic the wife for life insurance or vice versa, and two or three kissing. It's never ending with that, you know.
Well, you know, it starts to throw up all kinds of questions about our own society and morality, doesn't it? And the way we perceive things, and, you know, we want things to be black and white, but actually, you know, if we are just, you know, an extension of the animal kingdom, then it's not going to be black and white, because it's certainly not black and white out there.
Yeah.
You know, so the expectations that people have of their relationships maybe are unrealistic. But, you know, I didn't want to kind of get too far into that in the book, because I thought I was straying out of science and into something else there.
No, I like it because, you know, I'm sure the women out there like reading that one. That's a good one for women to read. That'll get them.
It's certainly true.
Yeah.
I've had some contact with people since the book's come out who've kind of said, yeah, you know, that was revolutionary for me, you know, to see that in print. You know, people actually coming out and saying that you know, there's much more complexity to, you know, to the world. I mean, of course, we live in you know, the US and the UK are very kind of male dominated patriarchal societies, and many of the animal kingdoms are not like that at all. So, you know, there's kind of scope for certainly food for thought there.
Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting that you're getting feedback on that. Your books, I think I got a copy of this book before it even came out, and it came out a couple of weeks later, and I probably had it read by the time. I actually read it twice. Second time,
oh, really?
Stuff. First time just to go through it.
Yeah.
And I think that women were going to enjoy this book. You know, you girls out there listening to our thing, and we did a lot of science, but I mean, just a pretty good sized chapter on sex here, and it covers a lot of interesting stuff. And the next one, of course, is free will.
Yeah.
I've got a friend of mine that comes on the show, is a doctor, and he's Dr. Colin Ross, and he wrote a book on the it's a book on the CIA and the sub projects of the CIA project MK Ultra, MK Artichoke, and a bunch of Project Artichoke and the Manchurian Candidate, and covered the 149 sub projects of mind control, where they actually put electrodes in humans towards the end of the whole thing. And I see you've got some pretty interesting stuff in here about how you can control the brain. You know, starts right off, as a matter of fact, about neuroscience. You want to explain a little bit about what?
I went to visit a neuroscientist called Patrick Haggard, who works at University College in London. And he just kind of was talking to me about, you know, the various ways in which you can control the brain from outside or control the body from outside. And
right.
he was talking about this this classic experiment by a guy called Itzhak Fried, I think, who was at Yale, who put electrodes in people's brains when he was trying to map their brains, and you know, they had various tumors and things that needed cutting out. And he found that, you know, they were saying to him, these people who were conscious, you know, while he was kind of manipulating the electrodes, they were saying, oh, I have this incredible urge to move my arm. And you know, he had a fairly low current on the electrode. And he found that when he ramped up the current on the electrode, people just moved their arm, you know, in all kinds of extraordinary positions. And he found he was able to be a, you know, a kind of puppet master, if you like. You know, if he put the electrodes in the right place and had the right current, he could kind of make them do all kinds of strange postures and bend their bodies over and put their arms behind their heads and that kind of thing. And Patrick Haggard was talking to me about this, and he said, you know, I can do something similar with a thing called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is basically a way of doing it sort of without putting electrodes in your brain, but inducing currents in certain circuits in your brain. And they will then, you know, move your arm or move your finger, depending on where they are and how strong the current is. And so I experienced this, and I have to say I didn't enjoy it one bit.
You didn't like it, huh?
No, I didn't like it. I really hated this idea that there was something, you know, I could watch him like turn this machine up and, you know, move my fingers. And the idea of somebody outside controlling your body, you know, it's like the one autonomy that you have really, isn't it? Is that you're in control of your body.
Right.
You're the one who decides when it moves. And the idea that this man was just like, you know, cranking this machine and moving my fingers around just really deeply disturbed me, I have to say. But you know, absolutely fascinating as well at the same time to have that experience, because it's not like the experience of excuse me, just like reflexes, you know, where somebody throws a ball at you and you catch it without thinking.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like that. It's literally like you're just watching somebody move. You're watching your hands move as if they're somebody else's hands. You know, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. What? How did he hook up the electrodes to your? Did you just put something on your head or something on your?
Basically, I mean, he did a very crude version, but he has this thing. It's like a paddle, you know, that just this big loop of wire that induces a strong magnetic field. And you know, when he puts a current through that wire and just holds it over your head, so he kind of, you know, it's like a magic wand almost. You know, he just holds it over your skull, presses a button, and you know, your finger moves. It's
He's got some pretty sophisticated equipment there, then.
Yeah, it was pretty extraordinary, I have to say. And I've never ever experienced anything like it. You know, I've done some crazy things as a journalist, but you know, just to kind of, in some ways, you know, it was completely ordinary in that when he wasn't doing it, you know, I felt like myself. But when he did do it, you know, I was like, you know, you're taking control of my body. This is unacceptable.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did ask him to show me, so I guess I only have myself to blame.
Yeah, did he must have had a lot of sub-frequencies that he hit those coils. Was it like one coil or a series of coils that he had all in?
It was two coils. And I guess what they do is they tune the coil to what are the kind of resonant frequencies of the circuits in the brain. So they induce this, you know, this magnetic field, which, you know, then induces a current in the brain. I don't know. I think it's probably quite a blunt instrument in some ways. You know, I think you can do a lot more subtle things if you actually implant electrodes. And he said to me to do it properly, he would have to map my skull in that, you know, he would have to know exactly, you know, where my brain was sitting and the various regions of my brain were sitting inside my skull to be able to kind of get some fine control. But it was nevertheless extraordinary. And he's one of these people who are in the majority now of neuroscientists who says, you know, we're really just machines that are, you know, organic machines. You know, we're made of carbon molecules and we're controlled by this, you know, piece of jelly that we call a brain, and it sends out chemical signals, it sends out electrical signals, and there's not much you can do about it. You know, that's just what we are.
Yeah, no, that's true. I agree. Except we got a, you know, we got the human spirit in there somewhere, but
but the human spirit must be a kind of, you know, it's still somewhere in that sort of, you know, those few pounds of jelly that we call the brain, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, there's nothing else in there. There's no ghost in the machine.
Yeah.
So. But it's quite a disturbing conclusion, I think. You know, this idea that you know, our whole society effectively has evolved, you know, with the concept that we are somehow, you know, in control of ourselves and that we should all, you know, take responsibility for our actions and things like that.
Yeah,
then,
I feel that some of the governments have ability to, from satellites, to actually control some people. I mean, this ELF stuff that's been going on. Have you studied ELF much at all?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't at all.
If you get a chance, you might want to look into ELF at some point.
Okay.
And the effects on the body. But sticking to your book, the one of my favorites in there is chapter 12, the placebo effect. If that isn't some entanglement, I don't know what is.
Well, you know, this is the whole mind-body connection, isn't it? And what a mystery that is.
Yeah.
You know, we are able to induce basically the release of chemicals and things, you know, by positive thinking, by expectation, by hope, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, we are able to, you know, to learn how to produce chemicals that change our physiology. And it's one of those things that science has kind of always acknowledged, but never really studied in proper depth, I think. And it's just now starting to appreciate, you know, the complexity of this and the potential that it offers, of course. You know, I mean, it's huge, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was reading in here, and I knew about it anyway, because I've, you know, been in the health field for a while, but you can actually take someone that's got some ailment and give them a placebo that does nothing, and the ailment goes away.
Yeah, yeah.
Or
yeah.
You can take somebody that might, you give them something that would be good for the ailment and doesn't do anything to them.
Yeah, and you know, there are these people who are placebo responders, and there are people who, you know, whose biochemistry seems to be different, and they don't respond in the same way. But it's an extraordinary thing to think that, you know, with some conditions, especially with pain, it seems to be the kind of conditions that you can't measure externally, but are just subjective assessments. You know, the placebo effect has a very strong kind of component here, and there was some studies done earlier this year into irritable bowel syndrome, IBS,
right,
where they found that people given placebos, if they were given them in the right way, in that, you know, they were kind of encouraged to, you know, talk about how they felt and kind of given time and space to talk about themselves. Yeah, you then give them a placebo. It actually worked as well as the kind of, you know, top-rated IBS drug. You know, so we've got this whole idea that, you know, we can use these things possibly to avoid, you know, treating everything pharmaceutically and thus avoid some of the side effects of these pharmaceuticals. So, but, you know, we're only just scratching at the surface of this now.
Yeah.
And there are people who say, oh, you know, it's all rubbish. It doesn't really exist as well. So it kind of, you know, we're in a real quandary, really.
Yeah, well, when people, you know, I always tell people, experimentation without, condemnation without experimentation is the height of ignorance.
I completely agree with you. And this is one of the things that's really happened with this field and with homeopathy, which is in the next chapter.
Go ahead, because I
like written
that.
It off without
Samuel
actually,
Hahnemann, you know, Sammy boy.
Yeah.
And Louis Pasteur, they split the field a few years ago.
Yeah.
So go on in. Yeah, you can talk about that with homeopathic, because homeopathic is definitely another form of entanglement in my mind, you know.
Well, I mean, it's really interesting because nobody understands how homeopathy might work.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, there are very few people who would say that, you know, very few scientists, I should say, you know, who would say, oh, you know, it definitely does work. And yet, you know, we're kind of, you know, used to hearing anecdotal reports from people all over the world about, you know, their positive experiences with homeopathy and how it does seem to have an effect. And so there's this whole kind of, for science, it's a really big quagmire, because I think science fundamentally doesn't really have the tools or hasn't yet developed the tools to cope with this and to kind of investigate homeopathy properly. And so, you know, what you've got is various practitioners, you know, are practicing it. And at the same time, scientists are kind of looking at it scornfully, saying it doesn't really work. But, you know, the patients are coming away and saying, well, it does work. You know, I've tried everything else, and homeopathy is actually the only thing that's done something.
Yeah.
And, of course, the ultimate argument that the scientists make against homeopathy is that there are no molecules of you know, this active drug sort of within the remedy that the patient is given. Therefore, how can it possibly have any effect? And I mean, that's a kind of non sequitur. You know, you can't say that something doesn't work because you don't know how it might work. And so, you know, it really does require a lot more work. I have to say, and I don't know if this is your experience as well, but I think there is a lot of muddying of the waters in homeopathic work.
People
aren't really sort of being rigorous about it.
No,
so that makes it even more difficult.
It falls somewhat into the New Age field with, you know, and there's much charlatanism going on.
Yeah.
You know, I believe that Samuel Hahnemann had a lot going on. I believe that the Bach flower remedies have an emotional effect on the emotional body due to the energy fields that they're created within their molecular structure, like pheromones,
right,
for example. So I believe in it from that standpoint, me. But in homeopathy, it's really pushed out of place. And one thing that I have found working in that field is that people that are very gross, meaning that they're large amounts of tobacco, alcohol, meat, you know, toxins in their system, respond rather poorly to homeopathic medicine, whereas people that are more towards the lighter side, you know, lighter alcohol consumption, not much meat, if any at all, they respond, you know, a little bit better, actually quite a bit better. And then some people don't respond at all, you know? I was one of those for a long time. I got into medicine because I was a sick kid growing up. I was born with polio at the University of Michigan, and I overcame it, and I still have a slightly sunken chest, a little bit. Look at, you know, not much, but it's there. And I wasn't the healthiest kid on the block growing up. And so I was always trying to, you know, for example, I used to get horrible pains in my leg when I was working over at NASA, working in those big hangars where we had all our craft and stuff.
Yeah.
Somebody told me, why don't you try vitamin E? Because I was wearing those elastic, you know, stockings that you wear. My legs hurt, and they put me on the heat treatments. You know, they would pay for it because it was. And I started taking vitamin E, and it all went away. My legs didn't hurt anymore, and that's kind of how I got into nutrition. You know, I was kind of forced into it.
Yeah. Well, I think this is the experience of a lot of people I've met who are homeopaths, for instance, who've just said, look, you know, I didn't believe any of it. I was really skeptical about it. But somebody said, just try this. And it worked so well that I've actually almost felt compelled to kind of go into more detail and learn, you know, more about how to do this. And I think, you know, I've met a few homeopaths while I was researching the book, and they all had extraordinary stories to tell. And you can't deny that, you know, if somebody says to you that, you know, my partner, for instance, as one of them did, my partner had chronic influenza, you know, had pneumonia, I think it was, every single winter until she tried homeopathy, and then it just went away for life. You know, you can't gainsay that, you know, by saying, oh, but scientific trials have shown that homeopathy have no effect. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And so what, you know, what we have to do is kind of have an open mind, you know, and not so open that our brains fall out, but, you know, actually sort of try and take this seriously rather than just dismissing it, which is what the mainstream of science does.
Yeah. Now, over here in America, on this side of the pond, there are more cancer clinics opening up that look at the, they'll do the chemo to stop, you know, mind-blowing, you know, termination of the body by cancer cells, and then they'll start easing off into meditation, and they get into homeopathic and nutrition and juicing and all that kind of stuff. So there is a compromise starting to take place. But I saw the drug companies, of course, don't like that. You know, I know a lot of medical doctors that have been threatened by drug companies if they don't prescribe more of their, you know, drugs. So drug companies to me, they represent nothing but control. I mean, they charge ridiculous prices and they want to control our entire world as far as I'm concerned, starting with
it's very difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because the drug companies are corporate entities, you know, with shareholders who want good returns on their investments, you know, who want the company's share price to go up, not down.
Yeah.
You know, there are pressures on these companies to get certain kinds of results, and yeah, it's completely understandable pressure. I mean, it's the same in any company, in any field. You know, you whatever your field, you want to make money. I mean, that's the purpose of the company. And the problem comes when the field is human healthcare, And, you know, what is best for the human being is not always what is best for the company.
Exactly.
And so we're living with this compromise, aren't we, in modern kind of corporate society.
Yeah.
But I'm encouraged at least that, you know, that these, clinics are offering properly complementary medicine. And I think, you know, we have to use the scientific kind of pharmaceutical approach as well as other approaches that, you know, whose sort of efficacy isn't so well known and not so easily defined. But I think, you know, you have to kind of take everything. And I've certainly known people who have, been, diagnosed with cancer and have ultimately, you know, been defeated by it and died. And they've used all the kind of medicine that's possible to use. And I think all you can do is use the power of the human spirit to kind of fight as much as, you know, you can use the power of chemotherapy.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that.
We have to use every tool at our disposal, don't we, in this kind of situation.
Yeah,
and it's
no,
very
totally
clear that,
that
positivity and positive thinking are a help. You know, they're a good thing. And we know that as well, don't we, from, you know, there's so many elderly couples that everybody kind of knows where, you know, the wife dies or the husband dies. And they've spent the last sort of 60 years or 70 years of their lives together.
Yeah.
And the other one dies within, you know, within months very often.
Yeah,
I
can name five couples that in my last decade or two that did that precisely that, you know.
So, you know, we have a will to live, don't we?
And
sometimes we lose that. And that has, you know, that's not some sort of airy-fairy spiritual thing. Yeah, that has physical effects. People die because they lose the will to live.
That's true.
And I think it's so important not to dismiss that because, you know, medically that is an issue that maybe we could take more advantage of than we actually do.
Yeah, I agree. I studied many years of meditation with Tibetans and I asked one of my teachers one time, what's cancer? And they said it's a will to live disease.
Yeah, that's a good description, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Do you ever notice
the type of person that contacts cancer? They're a person that has some kind of a burning desire to accomplish something or receive something or go somewhere or get something done. And they have a propensity typically to have a fairly bad diet to go with
right.
it and set themselves up. I mean, colon cancer is huge, and colon cancer is just by not enough roughage, you know, not enough fiber in the body would eliminate
yeah.
probably 90%
yeah.
of the colon cancer.
Yeah.
You start
yeah.
looking at, because I have, you know, from a homeopathic standpoint, probably done 1,000 cases of cancer. I had Michael L. Landon as a patient, for example. Remember the actor?
Was that
famous American actor over here. And I took him down to Charlotte Gerson, who Max Gerson, he was a very famous German doctor for cancer with alternative methods. And Landon was about to die, and Charlotte got him back on his feet again by using, you know, raw foods like a lot of celery. In other words, he had pancreas cancer, so they were putting
right.
the enzymes back into his body through a straw that his pancreas would have needed to produce to keep the body alive, and he got him back on his feet.
Yeah.
The problem we had with him is I asked Charlotte, is he going to live? And she says, no. And I said, why not? He's a great guy. He's a very humanitarian kind of guy. And she says, because he won't listen. He's going to get out of bed and go back to work and drop dead. That's exactly what he did.
Right.
Yeah. And then I had another case where I had Betty Lee Morales, who ran a ranch out here. She was head of the National Health Federation. She was the healthiest lady on the planet.
Yeah.
And her husband died she was in perfect health. Her husband died of an infection from a parasite, which was diagnosed after he was dead, of course. She died within
right.
2 months. Perfect health. Boom. Gone, you know?
Yeah.
I was
yeah,
shocked.
I think,
he went so quick.
I mean, you know, I wouldn't advise anybody who's diagnosed with cancer to, you know, pursue just one treatment or think that just, you know, thinking positive will do it. But I think it has to be part of the armory, doesn't it, that we can have... You know, we can have allopathic medicine, you know, traditional kind of scientific pharmaceutical medicine, and we can have, you know, other things, you know, we can eat raw foods or, you know, whatever approach, you know, your doctors recommend. It's so important that we kind of keep things open and just, you know, keep positive.
Yeah, you know, speaking of, you know, I've always been honored and respected and cherished allopathic medicine. You get in a car wreck or something, and they can put it
yeah.
together. homeopathic medicine won't work there too well. Allopathics can do it, you know. So I find a place, you know, probably like you for both of them. I just wish they would get along a little bit better, you know.
Well, the trouble is they're kind of, you know, they're fighting each other rather than kind of accepting that neither has the full answer, you know, which is a shame.
Yeah. So anyway, we're moving along here. This is a pretty good book. So what are you going to be writing, some more books here in the future, or what? What's next?
Well, that's a question I'm currently trying to deal with at the moment. I'm sort of worked out by New Scientist all the time, so I'm kind of looking for some space to think about what the next book might be. I'm very tempted to just, you know, kind of really try and take a look at gravity and just say, you know, what do we really understand about this? So that's
a fascinating subject. So you're into these gravity wave detectors and that kind of stuff too. Though.
I'm into everything to do with gravity because I just think we know so little about it, you know, and that just seems fascinating to me. You know, when Newton worked out his laws in the 17th century and really we're not that much further on, you know, certainly Einstein did his work a century ago and we know very little more basically. You know, maybe the Large Hadron Collider will tell us some more about, you know, the nature of gravity or mass, but you know, I'm kind of thinking that this is a big mystery, and it's almost never presented as a mystery.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, since I was a kid, I've been attracted by gravity. You know, I like magnetism. That's more obvious than gravity.
But, yeah.
You know, being the weak nuclear force and the strong nuclear force. And then gravity. you know.
Well, you know, there's a whole...
What is your take on it anyway at this point?
I think there are links between all of them. And you know, physics kind of points to the idea that all the forces were unified at, you know, the very sort of first moments of the Big Bang. So, you know, what is this link between gravity and magnetism, for instance, and electricity? You know, there's this idea that's been around for decades called gravitomagnetism, which, you know, may be the key to producing anti-gravity, for instance.
Right.
And so I think there's all kinds of things to explore here, which pretty much are largely ignored because people are working on one aspect and not the other, you know. So I think it needs somebody to kind of join the dots, really.
Yeah, I agree. Have you got any idea where you're going to start?
No idea at all. No, I'd like to start with having some space to think, but, you know, that doesn't seem to come around too often these days.
Yeah, I liked when I was studying Einstein's take on it, when he described gravity as an acceleration.
Yeah.
For some reason I never thought of it that way until I read what he had written on that, and it's kind of neat looking at it that way.
Yeah.
And then the expanding universe.
Yeah.
You know,
I can't help but think that, you know, we only have an approximation of what gravity is all about at the moment. We don't really have a kind of proper handle on it.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I've always thought of it as some sort of specific attraction of matter into itself. I mean, that's probably an obvious thought. But then I try, sometimes what I do is when I'm playing around with this stuff, I'll try to use some psychological human traits. You know, if it's true that, you know, that as legend depicts it, that man was created in God's image somehow, then go within and try to figure out what principle in the human psyche could possibly relate to an external cosmological, you know, problem.
Yeah, that's an interesting approach.
Yeah, that's the way I've always looked at consciousness. You know, I've tried to look at consciousness and how that works. And then I've run some drug rehabs. People on crystal meth and stuff like that. I've had an interesting background like you, and I've seen it how certain people are attracted to certain chemicals. There seems to be a gravitational attachment to these chemicals, which then cause their consciousness to go somewhere, usually destructive in the end. So I've tried pretty much every kind of approach there is to what gravity is imaginable to me. You know.
Right.
So I don't know if that'll help you out any, but
well, you know, I'm keeping an open mind on that, certainly.
Yeah, because when I look at your book here, when I look at this book and I see the field that you've covered, and I see that you're no idiot. I mean, you know you've got your background, your basic stuff down pretty good. to write the way you do. You're able to write in the way that I've learned how to write, learning how to write, and that is so people can understand you in the first place. You might understand you, but others won't.
Yeah.
And you've done a good job of that. I just want to say that, you know. So I think you're young yet too. So I think you'll be out there doing some stuff. If you ever get over to, you know, Liz was telling me you travel. Are you traveling quite a bit now, promoting your book or not?
Well, I'm not traveling so much. I'm coming over to the U.S. next month. In November. Just to New York City. So I'm doing a talk at the Haydn Planetarium.
That's great. Yeah,
I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Yeah, you might run into
But no, I haven't been out west for a long time. I'd like to get out to San Francisco and the rest of California again.
Yeah, have you ever been out
here?
It's
pretty much my favorite place on earth.
Yeah, you need to come to Laguna Beach. Come and see Dr. Fred here, you know?
I would love to do that.
Yeah, I will email you off-air my phone number and everything, you know? So you can have it. I think we've pretty much gone a couple hours here. Does that feel like
We have.
Yeah, I'm using a video recording here to do some stuff, and that says a little less, but I think they'll edit this thing down, but pretty much it's going to be intact, you know, having you on.
Okay.
And
that's great. I look forward to listening to it.
Yeah, yeah. And it'll be on BBS Radio on Friday night. It'll be, 2 o'clock in the morning for you? It's 6 p.m.
Yeah.
Pacific. But it'll be on this Friday starts, and the nice thing about it is that the show, we have archives on there, and our archives on this show are literally over the period of a year in the millions. And
wow.
Yeah, it's a show that perpetuates, and we've had a lot of good luck selling books, you know, that are good after interviews like this. And I think this was a fabulous interview. You know, I appreciate.
Well, great. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, we had a lot of trouble getting our timing together, but. It was a two-hour window. I wasn't going to let you get away with an hour because a guy like you in an hour, we're just warming up. You got
no. That's right. It was very obvious that we needed two, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that was good.
Oh, good. Great.
So anyhow, the title of the book we've been discussing is published by Bertelsmann & Doubleday. It's Michael Brooks. It's called The Most Baffling Scientific Mysteries of Our Time: 13 Things That Don't Make Sense. And like I say, we could probably add another 13 to that after this conversation, but we had a lot of fun.
That's great.
All right, so we'll be talking, and I will turn everything off now, and hopefully I'll email you, and we'll talk soon.
That'd be great. Thanks very much for your time.
Okay, thank you, sir. You have a great evening.
I will do. Thank you.
Bye.